But first, it's time for Laura. Laura, for once, let's start off on a reasonably happy note. There's a hint of reconciliation in the air.
Yes, it was. We actually had a bit of a good moment in politics last week, Philip. You know, the cynics amongst us, you know, and I think we might count ourselves. We'll be cynical about it, but nonetheless, the opening of Parliament has become sort of loaded with more and more ceremony. One of the good things that we have is the smoking ceremony, where we have the welcome to country and Indigenous people cleanse the place before it gets covered with blood and gore. And at that ceremony, both the Prime Minister and the opposition leader, Anthony Albanese, had sort of good words to say about committing to Indigenous constitutional recognition. And they were actually fine speeches by both of them. Scott Morrison talked about the experience of the opening of the old Parliament House in 1927 and reflected on how far we'd come in quite a moving story. And
well, I'm sorry, I've got to make the point, or make his point, that no Indigenous person was officially invited to that opening. There were, however, a couple of gatecrashers.
There were, who'd walked a very long way to get there and were asked to move on by the Wallopers in case they offended the Duke and Duchess of York by their decrepit appearance. And interestingly, the local people who were gathered there said, you know, no, rack off, leave them be. And in fact, they ended up being introduced to the imported royalty. And so it was a bit of a moment, but we haven't come a long way from there in a lot of ways. And Anthony Albanese made the point that it was time to move on from just having a welcoming ceremony to having an Indigenous voice.
It is good that there's a hint of bipartisanship on an issue that Parliament has so long chosen to neglect.
And essentially we know that unless there is real bipartisanship on this, it's not going to happen. Referenda are always really, really difficult, and this one in particular is fraught with difficulties. Some people in the Labor Party will say that pragmatically, it's only something that a Conservative government can move forward because it requires them to really be behind it. So I think these were sort of good signs from Scott Morrison, and he actually had a meeting with Anthony Albanese as Parliament started last week to talk about areas where there may be mutual agreement, and that was one of them. One of them was also the question of press freedom, though I don't know that we actually have got complete agreement between both sides on that issue.
Well, I've got to ask this. Are you making your travel arrangements available to the AFP?
Yes, I just thought I'd let Qantas know, as our colleague Sally Sara said, if Qantas could just let my mum and the AFP know where I'm going, that would be very helpful. But it's interesting, Philip. It turns out that there's some portal, and in some ways it sort of makes sense, where because of the nature of international travel and other travel, if various arms of the law want to find out where people may be going, they can essentially just go in and say, okay, we're investigating a crime, we need to know about Laura Tingle, that notorious bank robber or whatever, and they can find out without a formal warrant, as you'd expect in most cases. So this is one of the interesting things that has emerged from the story that was in the Sydney Morning Herald today about the fact that the AFP had asked or demanded, whatever the word is, that Qantas tell the AFP of what airline travel Dan Oakes had done. Now, he's one of the ABC journalists whose work prompted the raid on the ABC last month. So it's sort of all a bit unpleasant, really, because it's the documents we're now seeing show that the police were looking at criminal charges. I don't know if they still are, because Christian Porter, the Attorney General, insists that he can't see journalists being prosecuted. But certainly it was all framed as being a case against the journalists, and that they were looking at charges against them.
You mentioned blood a little earlier in our discussion, so let's look at the blood on the carpet. Who were the political winners and losers in the most recent parliamentary transactions? I guess one of the losers was Pauline Hanson.
Yeah, I think that's right, Philip. I mean, one of the things, there's been a lot of criticism from Labor supporters of the fact that Labor sort of rolled over on the tax cuts. Now, one of the things that was pretty much front of mind for Labor as it came back to Parliament this week is something that also affects Pauline Hanson, which is how do you stay in the game? How do you stay in the position where you're being talked about, where you've got a negotiating position, which means that people just don't write you off? Now, Pauline Hanson put up a really crazy series of demands about new coal-fired power stations and the revival of the Bradfield scheme for turning rivers inland and all sorts of things. And as a result, the government very quickly just said, well, we're not going to be negotiating with you about anything. Now, Labor tried to stay in the game, but ultimately couldn't because the coalition really wanted to, had a vested interest in boosting the role of part of the crossbench, which could be really crucial for them, which is the two so-called Centre Alliance senators, that's the old Nick Xenophon team, plus Jackie Lambie. And they really only needed those three votes, plus Cory Bernardi's vote, to get the tax cut through and marginalise Labor, because marginalising your opposition is even better than trouncing them. So there was a lot of that sort of almost psychological warfare going on last week about everybody having an interest in marginalising Pauline Hanson, boosting the crossbench and trying to make Labor look pretty irrelevant.
Although our new Prime Minister, or our renewed Prime Minister, is pretty much the master of all his surveys, isn't he?
Well, he is. It's interesting talking to some of the returning pollies last week. There was certainly an instruction that went out to the coalition benches not to look too triumphant. But in addition to that, just talking to people, they're very conscious that they're basically only one seat better off than they were before the election. They've got a two-seat majority. And given the experience we had in the last term of politicians falling left, right and centre for Section 44 in infringements or possible infringements or all sorts of other reasons, there's a real sort of apprehension around, I suppose, within the coalition that the sort of sense of master of all he sees is a pretty loose thing, that, you know, things can turn fairly quickly. So it's going to be interesting to see how long that sort of spirit is maintained.
Laura, I only half heard it, but there was a story running around that the new MP, the woman who replaced the unmentionable Tony Abbott, has talked of joining the Libs.
I think this has been somewhat over-egged, actually. If you looked at the quotes, Philip, I think it was probably a bit of bad language on her part. Not bad, but badly chosen language on her part. I think she was just saying, oh, look, that's not really something I've really contemplated and things like that. So I think that's a bit of wishful thinking on the Liberals' part. Zali Steggall has got a range of policy positions which are in line with the government, including on the tax cuts, but she has very different positions on climate change and everything else. So I think this is leaping well ahead of the story at this point.
Well, as you know, our next story is a celebration of Mum Shirl, so I'm going to end our encounter this week by quoting your most recent column. In the bleak winter of political cynicism, we can only applaud a rare moment of bipartisan ambition and optimism, referring, of course, to Indigenous affairs and constitutional recognition, parliamentary recognition. Laura, thank you very much.
Thank you, Philip.